This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahman, and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences, and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks, and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text, theme, or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, we are talking about our patron saint again, Sharat.
The patron saint of Night School.
Friedrich Nietzsche, and we're going to explore his conception of resentment, or in French, in much of the English translations, they retain the French, resentiment.
You know, when you say patron saint, it really speaks to me because I'm a kind of former Catholic, and the church had many saints. And the great thing about saints is you can always appeal to them for something.
Yes.
And so I don't know what you've gone to Nietzsche for. And I still haven't figured out what I want to go to Nietzsche for. But, you know, I'm getting my candles all kind of ready. Yeah. And one of these days.
Well, I keep returning to him over the years, and I find myself quite surprised at each time because you read a lot of different things over time, and some thinkers you forget and some discourses you just shelf completely, you know. But Nietzsche is someone I keep turning to, largely because he always unmasks the ascetic ideal, right, in his terms. But the way I appreciate it is to see this as a way of unmasking pretentious morality, where people's proclamations or attachment to certain value systems are not just about that. It's always about power, a certain form of compensating for themselves, a certain mask they put to present a certain character. So for Nietzsche, morality is always somehow linked to a certain desire for power or meaning in the world. And that's an entry point for some of the more fascinating ways of looking at the world that he presents to us. So that's one reason, that's one continuous theme for me.
What about the question of style? I don't know if this is sort of going at a tangent, but I mean, are you attracted to the way in which somebody presents their ideas? You know, because, you know, some people are very dry, for some people the writing is very dense, and you seem to have to, you know, deal with the fact that they're having a conversation in their mind with mm-hmm. previous, you know, mm-hmm. incarnations of their teachers, or whatever it is in other books. And there's something slightly lyrical, correct me if I'm wrong, something lyrical, poetic, or epigrammatic, or, you know what I mean? It's not a kind of like a textbook, a guy with, you know, point one, point two. You know, I can imagine a Malaysian lecturer would have a very hard time putting this as a PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah. You could, at the risk of compromising the experience of reading Nietzsche himself more directly. So you're right in the sense that Nietzsche's style, a lot of it's aphoristic, a lot of it is playful, it's provocative. He doesn't mince his words, largely to make the reading experience itself uncomfortable. So that's what he's going for. But I've heard this a lot. I don't read the German, but a lot of commentators I turn to frequently remark that his German style, his distinct personality through his prose, is one of the best in modern German literature. So that's an experience I don't get because I don't read it. But it just shows that it's, on one hand, provocative, but also aesthetic, in that the style he writes is beautiful. You know, you can see this even in some English translations. You know, there's a certain elegance despite the, you know, at times, venom or force behind those words.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about this concept we just mentioned, mm-hmm. resentment. Where do we go? Is it in one book, or is it like dispersed across his body of work?
It's dispersed, but the main treatment can be found in this book called The Genealogy of Morals, particularly in the second essay where he talks about the priestly class. Now, there's a technical way to approach this, and we can talk about that soon. But one way to think about this word, and this is where it resonates with me particularly, is that it harks very much to our conception of dengki.
Dengki and chimburu.
Chimburu is closer to jealousy. Dengki is when you are unhappy or bitter about someone else's success or someone else's well-being, right? There's this indignation in seeing the joy or the accomplishment of another person, and then you feel left out. You feel through looking at his or another person's advancements, you feel inadequate, right? There's a certain sense, a certain lack of love in Dengki that Nietzsche wants to point to. And he's saying that this is the wellspring, and he acknowledges its creativity and force, the wellspring of contemporary morality. The idea that, and in very general sense, just for starters, we appeal to morality, a certain standard, a certain ideal of goodness, and from there judge others to feel better about ourselves. And this is something that he noticed to be ubiquitous and a temptation that is very prevalent. You know, and I think we can sense now, right? Then people, and especially if you're more of, in the local context, more religious persuasion, there's propensity to correct other people's life, correct other people's behavior. And then you use a shared vocabulary of morality, rarely ever interrogating its basis or its legitimacy, right? But you take this thing for granted, right? So if somebody's dancing, you say, oh, that's haram. You know, somebody's wearing a certain dress, certain manner of clothing, and you say that's inappropriate. So you're checking other people's joy. You're being a killjoy. largely because you don't do those things, right? You don't have the same sort of freedom or certain sense of carefreeness in life. But that more complicated negotiation of other people's freedoms and your lack of freedom is obscured by appealing to these values, you know. And of course, I'm using a religious example because it's a simple one, but progressives do the same thing. You know, you're not socialist enough. Why are you going to Starbucks? Why are you shopping? You know, why are you taking money from a corporation?
You're so bourgeois.
Yeah, you should be struggling. Yeah. You know, you should be withholding yourself. You shouldn't be pursuing these joys.
You should use a cloth bag.
Exactly,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, where does this come from? This is the man from the 19th century. Mm-hmm. What is the precipitating historical or social condition that made him think, this is something worth reflecting on?
Mm-hmm. And like other existentialists, he was concerned with herd morality or herd mentality. The idea that we compromise or we willfully surrender our sense of self, a sense of authenticity, in order to fit in with others and to kind of really dissolve ourselves. And one of the ways that this happens is precisely to adopting dominant moral value system. The only problem is that you're not fully happy doing this because you compromise a great deal of who you are in order to sort of fit in or blend in with others. But that more difficult confrontation with that transition doesn't happen because what we end up doing is we latch on to this values system, right? So that's one facet of it. The other side to it is that Nietzsche is often or acutely preoccupied with the question of strength. What does it mean to be strong? And to be strong, in his terms, is to affirm life, to face the world, to be yourself in light of the world's demands and pressures on you, but that is often too much to handle, right? And typically, a cheap resort, a cheap recourse that people would take in trying to make up for this inability is to hold on to metaphysical values. So it could be religion, right? So the world, you pine for another world, you pine for another reality, and you hold on to it. But the same impulse can also be seen in morality. So one of the things that we can talk about later is how this is tied, how slave morality, the morality of resentment, is tied to certain demands that he sees in Christianity too. So
okay, you know, when you say the word herd, it really, I mean, it's kind of a bucolic image, right, of the herd of cattle, or maybe if you think the Serengeti, and you think of a herd of wildebeest or whatever, you know. But I think there is something about history at that point in time, right, 19th century going to the 20th century, is the emergence of republics, mm-hmm. right? The emergence of mass politics. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps his insights into his insights into people and certain dynamics can be read very well for the kind of societies that have developed over the last 200 years, especially, ones where, democracy becomes a ruling mode of existence, you know, in terms of not just in making choices about which political party leads you, but it's in the society. I mean, that's a democratic society. Everybody feels equal. Mm-hmm. But, Alexis de Tocqueville and all these guys noted, there was a deep leveling down as a consequence, yeah. right, yeah. In democratic societies. But, okay, let's come back to then the nature of the argument that he presents us.
Mm-hmm. So, just on that point, too, you're right. This was something that Nietzsche noticed, this emergence of a new social being that he felt did level all of us considerably and at the price of us being true individuals. So Nietzsche is not a democrat. In fact, in many ways, he believed in hierarchies of greatness. By this he means aesthetic greatness, you know, in the sense that not everybody is a musical genius. Not everybody is an epic poet whose work can last through the ages. So how are we equal? So that was it. So we are inherently unequal in value.
I mean, there's
sense.
Something compelling about that. I mean, of course, I think the counter argument with that would say, we're not making an argument for sameness. I mean, democracy isn't correct. An argument for sameness.
Yeah.
You can still say that people are special and unique and some people, you know, genius or whatever mm-hmm. you like, without destroying the democratic ethos.
Yes, yes. But the democratic ethos appeals to abstractions, right? In a sense that we're all of the same world regardless of the different ways that we strive to produce greatness. So, I mean, that's just Nietzsche's thing, which I don't quite particularly like. That's not why I keep reading him, but he is there.
Ooh, you're repudiating him. You do it three times and the cock will crow.
So, okay, just to start with, we can think of this notion of resentment emerging out of a tension between the nobility and the priestly class. And one way we can think about this difference is that both yearn for the same sort of freedom and excellence, but the nobility, they can live it. And Nietzsche describes their life as full of vigor. They dance, they're warriors, they're well endowed physically, they are socially ahead. And looking on nearby are these priests who yearn for those sorts of freedom, but can never somehow materialize it. The freedom remains idealized. They long in this idealizing of what the nobilities get to physically and materially acquire. But for the priestly class, that is repressed. So, and it is in that repression that they start brewing resentment. Why them and not me? Why do they get to do those things, but I can only desire it? And this is, for Nietzsche, the point at which the morality that we know of contemporary modern society began to brew. So let's pause here for now. So just note that distinction, and we'll get back to it in some detail in the second part of the show. I'm Ahmad Farid Rahman, alongside this week, Sharat Kutan, and we are talking about Nietzschean resentment, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Farid Rahman alongside Sharat Kutan as usual, and we're discussing resentment as theorized by Friedrich Nietzsche.
Okay, so the very evocative image when your description, just now, which of these guys, I can just see the priests, peering behind curtains, looking at all these nobles and, their well-endowed bodies and whatever and having fun and thinking, wow, I wish I was there doing it myself. But, it's such a commonplace emotion. We all have it.
Yeah.
We've had recently, I think, postings on Facebook by young Malaysians calling themselves the 1%, mm-hmm. talking about what mummy and daddy gave them, a Porsche, a Ferrari, or whatever it is, bling bling. And And part of it, you know, I think that there's a kind of talk around it, like, you know, it's outrageous. It's, you know, when people are, you know, tightening their belts and people are having a hard time making a living, that some people should be flaunting their wealth, right? But behind that almost legitimate outrage, is there also that priest, you know, pulling back the curtains, taking a peek at the nobles and saying, I wish I was that person having fun.
Yes. And the Nietzschean rendition of this situation would be to look at what are the values that are touted in the process. So if you see suddenly a moral distinction being made, I am frugal, they are boastful, right? So suddenly frugality is elevated as somehow being more moral, more valuable than,
ennobling,
say...
Ennobling, correct.
So that is the move of resentment, where the difference in capacities and enjoyment is extinguished by elevating yourself. So they're elevated by virtue of real-life gains, while the priest elevates himself by virtue of these metaphysical values, right? But key here is that morality becomes a game of who is more powerful. One appeals to real life things, while the other appeals to these metaphysics.
Yeah. What, are you a fan of Game of Thrones?
No, actually, I haven't
seen one episode. Well, you know, in, I don't know what season, maybe four or five, I don't remember now which season it was, it all blurs into one. Because there's this character, this priest who comes, he's barefooted and all that, you know, and that whole thing about the sparrows is precisely this, right? Their resentment against. And they turn the order, they turn mm-hmm. political order on its head precisely by manipulating a certain discourse of frugality, of poverty. Mm-hmm. So poverty becomes ennobling. So poverty is not something a problem we want to solve. I mean, social workers or sociologists or governments saying, well, poverty is bad. Yes. Let's try to elevate everybody and, you know, make sure that everybody's got a home, blah, blah, blah. This is, no, poverty is good. It's ennobling. It makes me pure. Mm-hmm. And that purity becomes the occasion for all kinds of then, okay, nasty politics.
Yes, yes. No, exactly. And
this is why you should be watching Game of Thrones.
I've been told that a lot. It's just that by now there's so many seasons, I don't even know where to start.
Oh, you know, take six weekends and you'll be done.
I might do that at some point because it is intriguing, even the premises. And this is where Nietzsche is going to link it to what Christianity eventually propagates, right? I mean, I love liberation theology, but they do that. They elevate poverty as a virtue, right? And it's amazing that this has compelled many priests to live in the mud with the poor, rejecting material values, you know, and while championing their causes, you're right. You don't see that concrete element beyond this very, granted, devotional and consistent commitment to poverty, you know? What's after that, right? I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but you see the power of upholding lack, the power of upholding scarcity for the weak becomes something that really galvanizes them, gives them a spring in their step, gives them meaning in life. And this is what Nietzsche wants to point out, right? How is this, for lack of a better word, ennobling you, right?
Okay, so another example, outside the kind of Christian tradition, I'm thinking of Gandhi here. Mm-hmm. And because Gandhi, again, you know, promoting those values, though some people might say that Gandhi's discourse was rather Christian in its you know, in
asceticism,
its,
yeah.
Because there's a whole tradition of asceticism within Hinduism as well. But also, I think behind it is this idea that if you're truly poor, one of the things that happens is you're vulnerable. You are sort of not insulated from all these external forces. Whereas if you were a priest within an institution as rich and as powerful as the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. or you were a politician as important And therefore, with all these major backers behind you, your life of simplicity, spinning, you know, whatever thread, mm-hmm. you know, in an ashram, perhaps purchased for you by your billionaire friend, you know, has this strange quality. It is really not the poverty of the farmer. We mm-hmm. have it today, farmers mm-hmm. in India killing themselves, this, you know, committing suicide mm-hmm. at this, you know, really dire rate, right? It's because that's what real poverty does.
Correct. I think that's a very important point. For Nietzsche, the nobility is always a minority class, whereas what the priestly class is going to latch on to are the values or the conditions of the slave class, which can relate even more so to actual experiences of poverty and lack and scarcity. So this is where Nietzsche talks about transvaluation of values, right? Which really means overturning certain values in your heads. But in this particular instant, what you have is the victory is when the Roman Empire adopts Christianity, thereby institutionalizing slave morality and, you know, giving it the sort of global push and power that, you know, that eventually leads to world history. So, but there's also a particular condition that ferments in the cultivation of slave morality, because it stems out of this deep self-absorbed sense of pity, your acute anchoring to your misfortune. You valorize lack and scarcity. You valorize patience rather than impulse. You valorize sort of like kindness rather than being proactive, and so on and so forth. Essentially, what this does in effect is corrupt you. This is a very, very interesting description Nietzsche has of slave morality, right? In that the nobles, and this is the phrase that Nietzsche used, can shake off the vermin in their skin. So if they get hurt, if they get insulted, they feel betrayed, they can just shake it off and move on. They absorb the pain and they shake it off and move on. But the priestly class, or those who adopt slave morality, this breeds inside them, right? And this is Nietzsche's description. His soul squints. His mind loves hideouts, secret paths and back doors. Everything that is hidden seems to him his own world. His security, his comfort. He is expert in silence, in long memory, in waiting, right? So your character is nurtured inwards in particular attitudes of resentment and indignation, whereas for the nobility, misfortune strikes and you just shrug it off and live, right? So key here is not so much that our appeal to values really mask our lack of power, so on and so forth, but that all this moralizing actually makes us worse. So I think, you know, maybe for a contemporary example, we've got to think too of, you know, when the ascetic ideal is held on to so much, when our radar is so moralistic, right? This is right. And of course, it's not that difficult to be so moralistic in a world where there's climate change, economic inequality, and, like, you know, the clash of empires happening in Southeast Asia. You can just turn around and judge everything, right? But what kind of a person does that make you, right? It's for Nietzsche, this propensity to constantly judge makes you more bitter. It internalizes more resentment and indignation, and this denies life.
Okay, so the conundrum is this, right? How does one speak of creating a new and just order, for instance, of egalitarianism, of solidarity and such? Maybe even, you know, one that's environmentally sound, without falling into this trap. I mean, is it possible? I mean, is Nietzsche kind of foreclosing the possibilities of that kind of discourse, or if you don't call it a discourse, that kind of demand we want to make on society, right? Because when you look at somebody who's wealthy, but who maybe gotten the wealth by, you know, illegitimate means, and you demand justice, and you demand that, and you demand redistributive justice, are you falling into this trap? I mean, are you by necessity mm-hmm. become a victim to this
kind of resentment? Of
like, yeah.
know if you can find joy in life. I think that is the key take in this formulation, that there is a certain extent to which your demand for a just world, because it takes so much idealizing, right? A world without climate change, it's very hard to imagine. You know, a world where there's no corruption, where there's no more imperialism, it's very hard.
Michael, this is sounding like John Lennon.
Exactly, right? And we get cynical, but say if we don't want to be cynical, we want to believe in it. It demands so much of our discipline and emotional consistency that it cannot rob us of life too. The task, and I don't know what the formula is to be a joyful moralist, a moralist who can still be open to the world, take its contradictions, and still find joy. You know?
Okay, so this is a kind of a typical attack on activists. It's a typical attack on, say, feminists, right? Men haters, and there's so many po-faced, activists who seem to be angry all the time. Mm-hmm. They can't stop being angry and outraged, and every moment is this. You know, it's like this endless peak of. Mm-hmm. Of outrage. Now, so is that just a stereotype, or do you think it's a consequence of seeing the world in a particular way?
It's a bit of both. I have in mind, I guess, a certain enthusiasm that people of particular religious worldviews have to see threats everywhere, right? So unwelcome DNA in chocolate, for example. Everything has to be stamped as halal or haram. You're all constantly constructing boundaries of morality. And that really robs you of this sort of free-spirited embrace of the world, right? Whereas I think, and there are a few activists out there who can do both, who can say, all right, this is bad. I'm going to make particular demands to you. But you know what? I'm still going to enjoy my Cadbury chocolate, despite the fact that it comes from some evil corporation, right?
I know a socialist likes to drink Coca-Cola. It's pretty high up in the socialist party. But okay, there are a lot of traditions of where there are rituals of purity and there's a concern. And maybe they too fall into the same trap, right? I mean, we think of, and this comes out of the critique of Hinduism in India, right? By, leftists in India. That, this Brahminic obsession with purity and, rituals of purity and what is polluting and what is not polluting. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see this replicated in many different cultures, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, is that just ways in which cultures are constructed to organize the life worlds of the people that populate it? I mean, they're just like what you can and cannot do.
I guess there's longer metaphysical background to what Nietzsche is trying to propose here, and that for Nietzsche, human beings are the animals that are most vulnerable to nature. And one of the ways that we face these uncertainties of nature, which make up really the contingencies of life, is to construct metaphysical systems. So we construct borders between nature and culture. And this happens through morality, right? Don't do this or don't do that. And you need to do this in a collective way, because evolutionary process depends on collective existence, depends on collective continuation, right? So metaphysics and morality is a way for us to cope and make sense of our vulnerabilities. So what links all these different instances, from whether you are a Hindu nationalist or like a Christian ascetic, is this inability to let go, right? To let go and just face the contingencies of the world a bit and find joy in it, right? Which is not an easy feat, because the world is harsh. He's not denying that. But do you want to keep boxing yourself in your little matchbox of values and really build your own prison through these value systems that are really constructed out of your heads anyway? Or do you want to find joy in life, right? And if you accept that this existence is all there is, there's no other like hereafter or whatever, then some joy in life should be somewhere in our agenda.
I'm with you, brother, on this. Joy, I think, is important. And but again, it's this, right? I mean, if you were writing a practical guide for activists, for instance, mm-hmm. How would you get them to remember this? I often say to people, just don't lose your sense of humor, And I think it's not me being facetious. It's not me saying, in a kind of glib fashion that, oh, you know, you shouldn't take your work seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But what humor does is it reminds you that the pictures that we paint are often much more complicated mm-hmm. than we often cast them, right? So we cast the world in black and white terms, but actually there's often irony lurking in the background.
Always, yeah.
willing to kind of trip us up, right? And we kind of embrace that, right? I think, but I don't know if that is a sufficient response to mm-hmm. this really troubling truth, as it were, that Nietzsche unveils for us about mm-hmm. how even the good people in their fight for making a better world end up doing things that perhaps self-defeating or sabotaging.
Yeah, and it really narrows the horizon, right? And this is the contradiction that Nietzsche wants to highlight about the priestly class or the discourse on slave morality, is that while on one hand it's very creative, it can really move us because it speaks to our weakness. It speaks exactly to the kind of thing that our weakness demands. We want our position to be elevated. And because we can't elevate it in the real world, we elevate it metaphysically. But the problem is that it doesn't necessarily make us virtuous, right? So there is a difference there between subscribing to certain moral codes and actually being emotionally healthy and vibrant human beings, you know, as humans in their kind of full emotional complexities. But, you know, it's hard too because, you know, in this world of climate change where we really have, before the crisis is already starting, it's going to peak maybe two more generations, my grandchildren maybe, if I get to have any, you know, you'll see
Sorry,
climate
I
refugees.
I didn't mean to laugh.
It's something I think about, you know, because, you know, and part of my reservations about sustainability, right? You want to live a sustainable life, less consumption, so on and so forth. And at some point, you know, being vegetarian is hard enough, right? You're trying to scan what you're consuming and where it comes from, its carbon footprint, so on and so forth. You just get so exhausted. At that point, you're too exhausted to even find joy in other things. It takes a bit of adjustment for you to kind of start, you know, just letting go, right? So it's very hard to, on one hand, to be constantly sensitive and to injustices, but at the same time, just saying, you know, F it, I'm just gonna like skip through the meadows, you know? So,
yeah, okay, but there's perhaps, you know, one solution, which is that the world order changes so it doesn't become so difficult. Maybe we would have to wait for a crisis where everybody is now being dished, you know, plain soy meal in order, and you have no choice. So, hey, you don't have to look around for it because that's the only food available to us.
And that's why I think commitment to the revolution, so to speak, is very important. But you need to find joy in the process as well. You know, I was thinking about this the last time that the world had faced the likelihood of an all-out catastrophe and breakdown was the First World War. Because you see this contradiction. On one hand, there was so much affluence, so much technology, right? There was the first encounter with the reality of modern civilization. But at the same time, all these empires were so confident that they could just win in an all-out battle with each other. And then look what happened, right? All that monstrosity, and it took a long time for them to realize just how much their ambitions were destructive. But at least the Russian Revolution came out of that rubble, right? So the next climate crisis where, you know, the next thing that's going to eat us alive is, you know, the all-out destruction of not just our lives, but our environment. What's going to come out of it? You know, what's going to come out of the dialectic?
We need to talk about the man who invented conceptualized the Gaia theory, because his position is that, of course, that we've gone beyond the tipping point, mm-hmm. and so we kid ourselves, you know,
you say that,
using
you
plastic say, you bags say and you know recycling.
You sound a bit too cavalier.
No. The thing is, I mean, he in fact, you know, he's now in his 90s, and his position is enjoy yourself because we're heading inevitably to destruction. But he sees the possibility of 1/10 of the human species surviving, and he thinks something good will come out of that.
Oh,
that's his kind of hope.
How do we get to that 1/10?
Well, because there's going to be catastrophic destruction, climate change, and, you know, extreme weather and all that, it will decimate most of human life. But the 1/10 that lives will then maybe find solutions.
What's the criteria? Did he say the criteria?
No. It's not like it's like an arc. It's not like, oh, sorry, you know, hold on, here's the number, you're going to get onto the arc. No, it's not like that.
I've already started building my arc, by the way. So.
Okay. Joy, are we time for recommendations?
Okay, yeah, time for recommendation. Genealogy, morality, I guess. I mean, it's the discussion here by, you know, locating the message in a contemporary setting is very different than the world Nietzsche had in mind. But I think there's some insights there that you can extend to what we're talking about today.
Okay, so I want to mention a book that I've tried to read and I haven't finished it. You know, I just started it, but you know, I got the first chapter. Lin Yutang's The Importance of Living. And he uses the book, he uses Chinese philosophy to kind of promote this particular worldview and approach to life. And I'll just say very quickly, for Lin Yutang, he thinks there's different types of philosophy in the Chinese tradition. And one of the things that he kind of like distills out of it is this idea of a scamp. And the scamp is an amiable loafer who wanders through life, learning, loving, and living. He's good-natured, a Renaissance man, dabbling here and there, connoisseur of nothing, dilettante extraordinaire. He's earthbound, a man of his biology and of his senses, and so on and so forth. This is Lin Yutang's kind of philosophy of how you might live your life. I mean, the approach, how you might comport yourself and such. So I think it's a book I keep thinking to myself, I must read before it gets too late.
Yeah. Before the world destructs. Yeah.
Lin Yutang, The Importance of Living.
Fascinating stuff. So you can email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook, BFM Night School. Just type that on the search space. Once again, Sharad, it's good to have you here. And you're going to have more of you, I assure you. I know you've been absent with the timing adjustments. I started teaching, so there's a new semester I had to adjust to as well. Thank you for listening. Sharad, you are on Twitter.
I am at Sharad Kutin.
Great. So this is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.